shopping, but I'd given Scott my word that I would do everything in my power to get to the bottom of this. And by bottom, I meant if Hank had anything to do with it, I would make him pay. And then there was Patch, my supposed ex-boyfriend, a guy who radiated mystery, left a strong impression on both Marcy and me, and had vanished without a trace. I couldn't picture myself with a boyfriend, but if I had to, I envisioned a nice, normal guy who turned in his math homework on time and maybe even played rec baseball. A squeaky clean description at odds with everything I knew about Patch, which wasn't much. I'd have to find a way to change that. At the farmhouse, I found a sticky note on the counter. My mom was out with Hank for the evening. Dinner followed by the symphony orchestra in Portland. The thought of her alone with Hank caused my insides to freefall, but Scott had been watching Hank Miller long enough to know he was dating my mom and had given me a clear warning. I couldn't, under any circumstances, let on what I knew to either of them. Hank believed he had us all fooled, and it was best to keep it that way. I had to trust that, for now, my mom was safe. I debated calling V, making it clear I knew she'd lied about Patch, but I was feeling passive-aggressive. Give her a day of silent treatment and let her stew over what she'd done. I'd confront her once I knew she was panicked enough to start telling the truth, for real this time. Her betrayal hurt, and for her sake, I hope she had a very good explanation. I cracked open a cup of chocolate pudding and ate it in front of the TV, using sitcom reruns to fill up the night. At last the clock slipped past 11 and I padded upstairs to my room. Peeling out of my clothes, it wasn't until I returned my scarf to its proper place in the drawer that I noticed the black feather again. It had a silky sheen that reminded me of the color of Jev's eyes, a black so endless it absorbed every last particle of light. I remembered riding beside him in the Tahoe, and even though Gabe was right there, I wasn't scared. Jev made me feel safe, and I wished I had some way to bottle the feeling, pulling it out whenever I needed it. Most of all, I wished I'd see Jev again. I'd been dreaming of Jev when my eyes snapped open. The creak of wood had penetrated my sleep, jerking me awake. A shadowy figure crouched in my window, blocking out the moonlight. The figure jumped inside, landing in my bedroom as quietly as a cat. I shot into a sitting position, and all breath left me in a whoosh. "Shh," Scott murmured, finger to his lips. "Don't wake your mom." "What are you doing here?" I finally managed to stammer. He pulled the window shut behind him. "I told you I'd pay a visit soon." I flopped back on my bed, trying to recover a normal heartbeat. I hadn't exactly seen my life flash before my eyes, but I'd come embarrassingly close to screaming at the top of my lungs. "You failed to mention that it would involve breaking into my bedroom. Is Hank here?" "No, he's out with my mom. I fell asleep, but I haven't heard them come in yet. Get dressed." I gave the clock a look, then I gave him a look. "It's almost midnight, Scott." "Very observant, Gray. As it turns out, we're going someplace that will be a lot easier to break into after hours." "Oh, boy." "Break into?" I echoed a little testily, still not recovered from being woken so abruptly, especially if Scott was serious about doing something potentially illegal. My eyes were finally adjusting to the blurry darkness, and I caught him grinning. "Not afraid of a little B&E, are you?" "Not at all. What's one felony? It's not like I have high hopes of going to college or getting a job someday," I quipped. He ignored my sarcasm. "I found one of the Black Hand's warehouses." Crossing the room, he ducked his head into the hall. "You sure they're not back yet?" "Hank probably has a lot of warehouses. He sells cars. He has to store them somewhere." I rolled over, pulled my covers up to my chin, and shut my eyes, hoping he'd take a hint. What I really wanted was to insert myself back into the dream with Jev. I could taste his kiss lingering on my lips. I wanted to live the fantasy a little longer. "The warehouse is in the industrial district. If Hank is storing cars there, he's begging to get robbed. This is big time. I'm feeling it, Gray. He's keeping something a lot more valuable than cars there. We need to find out what. We need all the dirt on him we can get." "Breaking and entering is illegal. If we're going to nail Hank, we have to do it legitimately." Scott came around the bed. He pulled the covers down until he could see my face. "He doesn't play by the rules. The only way this is going to work is if we level the playing field. Aren't you a little bit curious about what he's keeping in the warehouse?" I thought about the hallucination, the warehouse and the caged angel, but I said, "If it could get me arrested, no." He sat back, frowning. "What happened to helping me bury the Black Hand?" That was the thing. A few hours alone to reason things out, and I felt my confidence slipping. If Hank was everything Scott claimed, how could the two of us go up against him alone? We needed a better plan. A smarter plan. I want to help, and I will, but we can't just jump into this, I said. I'm too tired to think. Go back to the cave. Come back at a reasonable hour. Maybe I can talk my mom into visiting Hank at his warehouse and ask her what's inside. If I bring down Hank, I get my life back, Scott said. No more hiding, no more running. I'd get to see my mom again. Speaking of moms, yours would be safe. We both know you want this as much as I do, he murmured in a voice I didn't like. It was a voice that hinted at knowing me more than I was comfortable with. I didn't want Scott to have that kind of insight into me, not at midnight anyway, not when I was this close to slipping back into the dream with Jev. I'm not going to let anything happen to you, he said softly, if that's what's got you worried. How do I know that? You don't. This is your chance to put my intentions to the test, find out what I'm really made of. I snagged my lower lip between my teeth, thinking. I wasn't the kind of girl who sneaked out at night, and here I was, about to do it twice in 1 week. I was beginning to think I was 180 degrees from the person I liked to believe I was. Not so good after all, the devil on my shoulder seemed to taunt. The idea of going out after dark to spy on one of Hank's warehouses didn't exactly send a warm, fuzzy feeling through me, but I rationalized that I'd be with Scott the entire time. And if there was one thing I wanted, it was to get Hank out of my life for good. Maybe, if Scott was right about him being Nephilim, Hank was capable of mind-tricking one or two cops. But if he was doing something highly illegal, there was no way he could evade the entire police force. Right now, getting the police to breathe down his neck seemed like a good start to unraveling his plans, whatever they were. "Is this even safe?" I asked. "How do we know we won't get caught?" "I've been canvassing the building for days. Nobody's there at night. We'll take a few pictures from the windows. Level of risk is low. You in or not?" I gave a relenting sigh. "Fine. I'll throw on some clothes. Turn around. I'm in my PJs." PJs that consisted of nothing but a tank and boy shorts, an image I didn't want to sear into Scott's mind. Scott smiled. "I'm a guy. That's like asking a kid not to glance at the candy counter." Ugh. The dimple in his cheek deepened, and it was not in any way cute. Because I wasn't going down this road with Scott. I made the decision instantly. Our relationship was complicated enough. If we were going to work together, platonic was the only way to go. With a wry smile, he raised his arms in defeat and gave me his back. I scrambled out of bed, loped across the room, and shut myself in the closet. Since the doors were slatted, I left the light off just to be safe and felt my way down the rack of clothes. I tugged on a pair of skinny jeans, a layering tee, and a hoodie. I opted for tennis shoes, fearing we might have to run at a moment's notice. Buttoning the top of my jeans, I opened the closet door. "You know what I'm thinking right now?" I asked Scott. His eyes scanned me. "That you look cute in that girl next door way?" Why did he have to say things like that? I felt a blush spring to my cheeks and hoped Scott missed it in the dim light. I said, "That I'd better not regret this." Chapter 16. Scott's mode of transportation was a 1971 Dodge Charger. Not the quietest of cars for a guy who insisted we keep a low profile. Add on the fact that the tailpipe sounded like it had developed a crack, and I was pretty sure we could be heard rocketing around from several blocks away. Even though I thought we were only piling on the suspicion by thundering through town with our hoods up, Scott was adamant. "The Black Hand has spies everywhere," he informed me yet again. As if to punctuate his point, his eyes flicked to the rearview mirror. "If he catches us together..." He let the sentence dangle. "I get it," I said. Brave words considering they sent a shudder right through me. I preferred not to think about what Hank would do if he suspected Scott and I were spying on him. "I shouldn't have taken you to the cave," Scott said. "He'd do just about anything to find me. I wasn't thinking about how this would impact you." "It's okay," I said, but that ominous chill hadn't vanished. "You were surprised to see me. You weren't thinking."
"Neither was I. I'm still not thinking," I added with a shaky laugh. "Otherwise, I wouldn't be snooping around one of his warehouses.
Is the building under video surveillance?"
"No. My guess is the Black Hand doesn't want any extra evidence proving what goes on there," Video can leak, he added meaningfully. Scott parked the Charger by the Wentworth River under the low-hanging branches of a tree, and we swung out. By the time we'd walked a block, I couldn't see the car when I glanced over my shoulder. I suppose that was what Scott had been going for. We crept alongside the river, the moon too thin to cast our shadows. We crossed Front Street, weaving between old brick warehouses, slender and tall, built one right after another. The original architect clearly hadn't wanted to waste space. The building's windows were greased over, barred with iron, or covered from the inside with newsprint. Trash and tumbleweeds crammed the foundations. "That's the Black Hands warehouse," Scott whispered. He pointed in the direction of a four-story brick structure with a rickety fire escape and arched windows. "He's gone inside it 5 times in the past week. He always comes just before dawn when the rest of town is sleeping. He parks several blocks away and walks the rest of the way on foot. Sometimes he'll circle a block twice, just to make sure he's not being followed. You still think he's storing cars?" I had to admit, the chances of Hank taking that kind of precaution over Toyota inventory was pretty low. If anything, it sounded like he was using the building as a chop shop, but I didn't really believe that either. Hank was one of the wealthiest and most influential men in town. He wasn't desperate to make a little cash on the side. No, something else was going on. And by the way the hairs on the back of my neck stood on end, I predicted it wasn't good. "Are we going to be able to see inside?" I asked, wondering if the windows on Hank's building were blacked out like the others. We were still too far away to tell.
"Let's move up another block and find out."
We hugged each building along the way so closely the bricks snagged my hoodie. At the end of the block, we were close enough to Hank's building to see that while the windows on the bottom 2 floors were covered in newspaper, those on the top 2 floors had been left unobstructed.
"You thinking what I'm thinking?"
Scott asked with a mischievous gleam in his eyes. "Climb the fire escape and have a look inside?"
"We could draw lots. Loser goes up."
"No way. This was your idea. You should go up."
"Chicken,"
he grinned, but sweat glistened on his forehead. He pulled out a cheap disposable camera.
"It's dark, but I'll try to get a few clean pictures."
Without another word, we ran in a crouch across the street. We hurried down the alley behind Hank's building and didn't stop until we were hidden behind a dumpster splashed with graffiti. I braced my hands on my knees and swallowed air. I couldn't tell if my shortness of breath was due to the running or anxiety. Now that we'd come this far, I suddenly wished I'd stayed behind in the Charger. Or stayed home, period. My greatest fear at this point was being discovered by Hank. How certain was Scott that we weren't being caught on surveillance tape at this very moment? "Are you going up?" I asked, secretly hoping he'd developed cold feet too and would make an executive decision to retreat to the car.
"Or in. What are the chances the Black Hand forgot to lock up?"
he asked, jerking his head in the direction of a row of truck bay doors. I hadn't noticed the bay doors until Scott pointed them out. They were raised off the ground and set back in an alcove, perfect for loading and unloading cargo privately. There were 3 in a row, and something clicked in my head when I saw them. They looked a lot like the bay doors I'd pictured during my hallucination in the school bathroom. The warehouse also had a creepy resemblance to the other hallucination I'd had with Jev by the side of the road. I found the coincidences eerie, but wasn't sure how to raise the issue with Scott. Telling him, "I think I saw this place during one of my hallucinations," wasn't going to earn me a lot of credibility. While I was still pondering the spooky connection, Scott leaped up on the cement ledge and tried the first bay door. Locked. He moved to the keypad.
"What do you think the code is? Hank's birthday?"
"Too obvious."
"His daughter's birthday?"
"Doubtful." Hank didn't strike me as stupid.
"Back to plan A, then,"
Scott sighed. He jumped, catching the bottom rung of the fire escape. A layer of rust sprinkled down and the metal gave a low groan of protest, but the pulley worked, the chain fed through it, and the ladder lowered.
"Catch me if I fall,"
was all he said before going up. He tested the first couple of rungs, bouncing his weight against them. When they didn't give, he continued up, one cautious step at a time, to minimize the creaking metal. I watched him all the way to the first landing. Figuring I should keep watch while Scott climbed, I poked my head around the side of the building. Ahead, at the adjacent corner, a long, knife-like shadow spread across the sidewalk, and a man stepped into view. I pulled back.
"Scott!"
I whispered up, my voice the barest sound. He was too high to hear. I glanced around the edge of the building a second time. The man stood on the corner with his back to me. Between his fingers burned the orange glow of a cigarette. He leaned into the street, glancing both ways down it. I didn't think he was waiting for a ride, and I didn't think he'd stepped out of work for a smoke. Most of the warehouses in this district had been retired years ago, and it was past midnight. Nobody was working at this hour. If I had to bet, the man was guarding Hank's building. Further proof that whatever Hank was hiding had value. The man ground his cigarette beneath his boot, glanced at his watch, and started a bored amble toward the alley.
Scott!
I hissed, cupping my mouth. We have a problem! Scott was well past the second level, only a few steps away from the third-story landing. The camera was in his hand, ready to take pictures the minute he had a clear shot. Realizing he wasn't going to hear me, I grabbed a piece of gravel and threw it at him. Instead of hitting him, however, the rock hit the fire escape, ringing out with a clang, clang, clang as it bounced back down. I covered my mouth, paralyzed by fear. Scott looked down and froze. I jabbed my finger urgently at the side of the building. Then I ran to the dumpster, crouching behind it. Through the crack between the dumpster and the building, I watched Hank's guard jog into view. He must have heard the pebble I'd thrown, because his eyes immediately traveled up, trying to pinpoint the sound.
Hey!
He yelled at Scott, jumping onto the bottom rung of the fire escape and hauling himself up with a speed and agility that very few humans could match. He was tall, too, one of the easiest ways Scott had taught me I could spot in a feel. Scott clambered up the fire escape, taking the rungs two at a time. In his hurry, the camera slipped from his hand, sailing down to the alley where it shattered. He gave it one brief glance of disbelief before resuming his rushed ascent. At the fourth-story landing, he hauled himself up the ladder that hooked onto the rooftop and disappeared above. I ran down my options in a hurry. The Nafil guard was only a flight behind Scott, moments away from cornering him on the roof. Would he rough up Scott? Haul him back down for questioning? My stomach lurched. Would he call Hank here to deal with Scott directly? I hustled out to the front of the building and craned my neck, trying to locate Scott. As I did, a shadow streaked overhead. Not along the edge of the rooftop, but in the air between this building and the one across the street. I blinked, clearing my vision just in time to see a second comet race across the sky, arms and legs pinwheeling athletically. My jaw dropped. Scott and the Nafil were jumping buildings. I didn't know how they were doing it, and there wasn't time to dwell on the impossibility of what I was seeing. I sprinted toward the charger, trying to anticipate Scott's mind. If we could both beat the Nafil to the car, we stood a chance of getting away. Pumping my arms harder, I followed the sound of their shoes ringing and scuffing far overhead. Halfway to the car, Scott veered suddenly to the right, and the Nafil followed. I heard the last of their impossibly fast footsteps sprint into the darkness. As they did, a metallic chime rang out on the sidewalk just ahead. I scooped up the car key. I knew what Scott was doing, diverting the Nafil long enough to give me a chance to get to the car before they did. They were faster, much faster, and without an extra few minutes, I'd never make it. Still, Scott couldn't take the Nafil on a wild goose chase forever. I had to hurry. At Front Street, I put on one final burst of speed and sprinted the last block to the charger. I was lightheaded, blackness crowding my vision. Clutching my side, I leaned against the car, catching my breath. I scanned the rooftops intently, hunting for any sign of Scott or the Nafil. A figure streaked off the side of the building straight ahead, legs and arms revolving through air as he dead-dropped. At the bottom of four stories, Scott hit the ground, stumbled, and rolled. The Nafil was right on his tail, but nailed the landing. He yanked Scott off the ground and delivered a fierce blow to the side of his head. Scott staggered, but remained conscious. I wasn't sure he'd be able to manage as much with a second well-aimed punch. With no time to think, I threw myself into the charger. I shoved Scott's key into the ignition. Flipping on the headlights, I floored it straight for Scott and the Nafil. My hands gripped the steering wheel, bloodless. Please, let this work. Both Scott and the Nafil spun to face me, their complexions washed out in the headlights. Scott shouted at me, but I couldn't make out the words. The Nafil shouted, too. At the last moment, he released Scott and dodged away from the car's bumper. Scott wasn't as lucky. He flew up and over the hood. I didn't have time to wonder if he'd been injured before he hurled himself into the seat beside me.
Go!
I stomped the gas.
What was that back there? I shrieked. You were jumping buildings like they were hurdles.
I told you I'm stronger than your average guy.
Yeah, well, you didn't mention flying, and you told me you didn't like using those strengths.
Maybe you changed my outlook. A cocky smile. So you were impressed?
That Nafeel back there nearly captured you, and that's all you care about?
Thought so.
He sounded self-satisfied, clenching and unclenching his hand where the black hand's ring fit snugly around his middle finger. I didn't think now was the time to press for an explanation, especially given the relief I felt over his decision to start wearing it again. With it, Scott stood a chance against Hank, and I did as well, by association.
Thought what? I said, frazzled. You're blushing.
I'm sweating. When I realized what he was getting at, I rushed on. I am not impressed. What you did back there, what could have happened? I shoved some stray hairs off my face and collected myself. I think you're reckless and careless, and you've got some nerve making this all sound like a big joke. His smile turned into a full-on grin.
No further questions. I have my answer.
Chapter 17. Scott drove me home and was far more liberal with the speed limit than I'd ever been. He parked a distance from the farmhouse at my insistence. The entire ride home I juggled two kinds of fear. First, that the Nafeel guard had somehow followed us despite Scott's careful measures, and second, that my mom would beat us home. Chances were she would have speed-dialed my cell the moment she found my bed empty, but then again, maybe her seething rage at my second count of reckless disobedience in less than a week had rendered her speechless. Well, that was exciting, I told Scott, my voice pale. He thumped his hand on the steering wheel.
30 more seconds. That's all I needed. If I hadn't dropped the camera, we'd have pictures of the warehouse.
He wagged his head in disbelief. I was about to tell him that if he had thoughts of going back, he should find another sidekick, when he said soberly,
If the guard got a good look at me, he's going to tell Hank. Even if he didn't see my face, he could have seen my brand. Hank will know it was me. He'll send a team out to search the area.
His eyes flicked to mine.
I've heard rumors of Nephilim being locked away in reinforced prisons for life. Underground chambers in the woods or beneath buildings. You can't kill a Nephil, but you can torture him. I'm going to have to lie low for a while.
What brand? Scott stretched the collar of his shirt down, revealing a small circle of skin that had been seared with the mark of a clenched fist identical to the one on his ring. The flesh had healed, but I could only imagine how raw and painful it had once been.
The Black Hand's mark. It's how he forced me into his army. On the bright side, he wasn't smart enough to embed a tracking device.
I wasn't in the mood to joke and didn't return his half-smile. Do you think the guard saw your brand?
Can't say.
Do you think he saw me?
Scott shook his head. We couldn't see anything through the headlights. I only knew it was you because I recognized the charger.
This should have made me breathe easier, but I was wound so tight, a sigh of relief was out of the question.
Hank could drop your mom off at any minute. Scott jerked his thumb at the road. I've got a roll. I'm going to keep my head down for a few weeks. Hopefully the guard didn't see my mark. Hopefully he thinks I'm a common thug.
Either way, he knows you're Nephilim. Last I checked, humans don't jump buildings. When Hank finds out, I don't think he's going to brush this off as a coincidence.
All the more reason to back off. If I disappear off the grid, Hank might think I got scared and left town. When this blows over, I'll find you. We'll draft a different plan and take him down from a new angle.
I felt my patience shredding. What about me? You're the one who put this whole idea into my head. You can't bail now. He's dating my mom. I don't get the luxury of lying low. If he was involved in my kidnapping, I want him to pay. If he's planning even worse things, I want him stopped. Not in a few weeks or months, but now.
And who is going to get rid of him?
His voice was gentle, but there was an underlying firmness.
The police? He's got half of them on his payroll, and the other half he could mind trick into submission. Listen to me, Nora. Our plan is to ride this out. We have to let the dust settle and make the Black Hand think he's in charge again. Then we'll regroup and try a different attack when he's least expecting it.
He is in charge. It's not a coincidence he's suddenly dating my mom. She isn't his top priority. Building his Nephilim army is. Cheshvan starts next month, in October. So why her? Why now? How does she fit into his plans? I have to figure this out before it's too late.
Scott tugged on his ear irritably.
I shouldn't have told you anything. You're going to crumble. The Black Hand is going to call you out from a mile away. You're going to talk. You're going to tell him about me and the cave.
Don't worry about me, I snapped. I pushed out of the charger and gave him one parting shot before slamming the door.
Lilo, fine, but you're not the one whose mom is falling more in love with that monster by the day. I'm going to out him with or without you.
Of course, I had no idea how. Hank had embedded himself so deeply in this town, he was at its very core. He had friends, allies, and employees. He had money, resources, and his own private army. Most worrisome of all, he had my mom clenched in his fist. 2 days passed with little excitement. True to his word, Scott vanished. In hindsight, I regretted blowing up at him. He was doing what he had to, and I couldn't blame him for that. I'd accused him of bailing, but that wasn't the case at all. He knew when to push and when to pull back. He was smarter than I'd given him credit for, and patient. And then there was me. I didn't like Hank Miller, trusted him even less, and the sooner I figured out his endgame, the better. Cheshvan hung like a black cloud at the back of my thoughts, a constant reminder that Hank was planning something. I didn't have hard proof that my mom was part of that plan, but there were red flags. Given everything Hank was trying to accomplish before Cheshvan, including building and training an entire Nephilim army to win back possession of their bodies from fallen angels, why was he devoting so much time to my mom? Why did he need her trust? Why did he need her, period? It wasn't until I was sitting in AP History, listening half-heartedly to my teacher describe the events leading up to the English Protestant Reformation, that a light bulb blazed on. Hank knew Scott. Why hadn't I thought of it before? If Hank suspected that Scott was the Nephil responsible for snooping around his building 2 nights ago, he knew Scott wouldn't risk a second pass so soon after getting caught. In fact, Hank probably assumed Scott had scrambled straight into hiding, which he had. Never in a million years would Hank expect another trespasser as early as tonight. Never in a million years. Evening came and went. At 10, Mom kissed me goodnight and retreated to her bedroom. An hour later, her light clicked off. I waited an extra minute or two to be sure, then flung off my covers. Fully dressed, I grabbed a duffel packed with a flashlight, a camera, and my car keys from under my bed. As I pushed the Volkswagen soundlessly down Hawthorne Lane, I inwardly thanked Scott for buying me a light vehicle. I never could have done this with a truck. It wasn't until I was a good quarter mile from the farmhouse and far out of my mom's hearing range that I started the engine. 20 minutes later, I parked the Volkswagen a few blocks from where Scott had left the charger 2 nights ago. The scenery hadn't changed. Same boarded-up buildings, same streetlights in disrepair. In the distance, a train blew a forlorn whistle. Since Hank's building was guarded, I discarded the idea of going anywhere near it. I was going to have to find another way to look inside. An idea struck me. If there was one thing I could use to my advantage, it was the construction. The buildings were built one right next to the other. I could probably see inside Hank's building from the one directly behind it. Sticking to the route Scott and I had taken, I jogged closer to Hank's building. Crouching in the shadows, I settled in for my first stab at surveillance. I noticed that the fire escape had been promptly removed. Hank was being careful then. There was fresh newsprint covering the third floor windows, but whoever had started the job hadn't made it to the fourth floor yet. Every 10 minutes, like clockwork, a guard exited the building and walked the perimeter. Convinced I had enough information to go on, I circled the block, coming out near the building that backed to Hank's. As soon as the guard finished his walk around and retreated inside Hank's building, I sprinted into the open. Only this time, instead of hiding in the alley behind Hank's building, I hid one alley down. Standing on top of an overturned trash can, I tugged the fire escape down to ground level. I was afraid of heights, but I wasn't about to let that fear get in the way of finding out what Hank was hiding. Taking some shallow breaths, I climbed to the first landing. I told myself not to look down, but the temptation was too strong. My eyes swept the alley below, seeing it through the iron latticework of the fire escape. My stomach cramped and my vision blurred. I climbed to the second level, up to the third. A little nauseated, I tried the windows. The first few were locked, but finally I jimmied one loose and it opened with a gritty whine. Camera in hand, I stuffed myself through the window. I'd just come to a full stand inside when I was blinded by lights. I threw my arm over my eyes. All around, I heard the sounds of stirring bodies. When I opened my eyes again, I gazed at row upon row of cots. One sleeping body in each cot. All male, all exceptionally tall. Nephilim. Before I could form a follow-up thought, an arm hooked my waist from behind. "Move," a low voice ordered, hauling me back toward the window I'd come through. Snapping out of my daze, I felt the pair of strong arms drag me back through the window and onto the fire escape. Jev gave me a hasty look over, his eyes brimming with aggravation. Wordlessly, he pushed me toward the rungs. As we clambered down the fire escape, shouts echoed from the front of the building. Any minute now, we were going to find ourselves trapped from above and below. Making an impatient sound, Jev scooped me into his arms, holding me flush against him. "Whatever you do, don't let go." I'd barely fastened my grip when we were flying, straight down. Without bothering to use the fire escape, Jev had jumped over the railing. Air ripped past us as gravity pulled us toward the alley below. It was over before I could scream, my body jolting with the impact of landing, and just like that, I was back on my own 2 feet. Jev grabbed my hand and yanked me toward the street. I'm parked 3 blocks away. We rounded the corner, ran a block, cut up an alley. Ahead, parked at the curb, I saw the white Tahoe. Jev key-fobbed the doors open and we flung ourselves inside. Jev drove fast and hard, screeching around corners and flooring it down the straightaways until he'd put miles between us and the Nephilim. At last he bounced the Tahoe into a little 2-pump gas station halfway between Coldwater and Portland. A closed sign hung in the window, with only a few dim lights burning inside. Jev cut the engine. "What were you doing back there?" His volume was low, his tone furious. "Climbing the fire escape, what did it look like?" I shot back. My pants were torn, my knees were scuffed, my hands were scraped, and getting angry was the only thing stopping me from bursting into tears. "Well, congratulations, you climbed it, and nearly got yourself killed. Don't tell me you were there by coincidence. Nobody hangs out in that neighborhood after dark. And that was a Nephilim safe house you barged into, so again, I'm not buying that it was by accident. Who told you to go there?" I blinked. "A Nephilim safe house? You're going to play dumb?" He shook his head. "Unbelievable." "I thought the building was vacant. I thought the building next to it was the Nephilim warehouse." "Both are owned by a Nephil, a very powerful Nephil. One is a decoy and the other sleeps about 400 Nephilim on any given night. Guess which one you walked into." "A decoy? How smart of Hank. Too bad I hadn't thought of it 20 minutes ago. He'd have the entire operation relocated by tomorrow morning, and I'd lose my only lead. At least now I knew what he was hiding. The warehouse was the sleeping quarters for at least a portion of his Nephilim army. "I thought I told you to stop looking for trouble. I thought I told you to try normal for a while," Jev said. "Normal didn't last very long. Right after I last saw you, I bumped into an old friend. An old Nephil friend." I'd let the words fly out without thinking, but I didn't see the harm in telling Jev about Scott. After all, Jev had taken my side when I'd argued with Gabe to release BJ, so he couldn't hate Nephilim the way Gabe clearly did. Jev's eyes hardened. "What Nephil friend?" "I don't have to answer that." "Forget it, I already know. The only Nephil you'd be gullible enough to call a friend is Scott Parnell." I wasn't fast enough to hide my surprise. "You know Scott?" Jev didn't answer, but I could tell by the quiet, killer look in his eyes that he didn't think highly of Scott. "Where's he staying?" he asked. I thought of the cave and how I'd promised Scott I wouldn't tell anyone. "He didn't tell me. I bumped into him when I was out running. It was a brief conversation. We didn't even have time to exchange phone numbers."
"Where were you running?"
"Downtown," I lied easily. "He stepped out of a restaurant as I was passing and recognized me, and we talked for a minute."
"You're lying. Scott wouldn't be out in the open like that, not when the Black Hand has a price on his head. I'm betting you saw him somewhere more remote. The woods by your house?"
he guessed. "How do you know where I live?" I asked nervously.
"You've got an untrustworthy Nephil shadowing you. If you're going to worry about something, worry about that."
"Untrustworthy? He filled me in on Nephilim and fallen angels, which is more than I can say about you." I gathered my cool. I didn't want to talk about Scott. I wanted to talk about us and force Jev to open up on our past connection. I'd been fantasizing about seeing him for days, and now that I had what I wanted, I wasn't about to let him slip away again. I needed to know who he'd been to me.
And what did he tell you? That he's the victim? That fallen angels are the bad guys? He can blame fallen angels for the existence of his race, but he isn't a victim, and he isn't harmless. If he's hanging around, it's because he needs something from you. Everything else is a pretense.
Funny you should say that, since he hasn't asked me for a single favor. So far, it's been all about me. He's trying to help me get my memory back. Don't look so surprised. Just because you're a closed-off jerk doesn't mean the rest of the world is, too. After shedding light on Nephilim and fallen angels, he told me Hank Miller is building an underground Nephilim army. Maybe that name means nothing to you, but it means a lot to me, since Hank is dating my mom. The scowl faded from his face.
What did you just say? He asked in a genuinely menacing voice.
I called you a closed-off jerk, and I meant every word. He narrowed his gaze beyond the window, clearly thinking, and I got the distinct impression he'd found something I'd said important. A muscle in his jaw clenched, a dark and frightening look bringing a cold edge to his eyes. Even from where I sat, I sensed the tightening of his body, a current of underlying emotion, none of it good, flexing under his skin.
How many people have you told about me? He asked.
What makes you think I've told anyone about you? His eyes pinned me in place.
Does your mom know?
I debated another snide comment, but was too exhausted to put in the effort. I might have mentioned your name, but she didn't recognize it. So we're back at square one. How do I know you, Jev?
If I asked you to do something for me, I don't suppose you'd listen.
When he had my attention, he continued.
I'm going to take you home. Try to forget tonight happened. Try to act normal, especially around Hank. Don't mention my name.
By way of an answer, I shot him a black look and swung out of the Tahoe. He followed suit, coming around to my side.
What kind of answer is that?
He asked, but his voice wasn't nearly so gruff. I stalked away from the Tahoe in case he thought he could use force to stuff me back into the car. I'm not going home, not yet. Ever since the night you saved me from Gabe, I've been thinking of all the ways I could run into you again. I've spent way too much time speculating how you knew me before, how you knew me at all. I might not remember you or anything else from the past 5 months, but I can still feel, Jev. And when I first saw you the other night, I felt something that I've never felt before. I couldn't look at you and breathe at the same time. What does that mean? Why don't you want me to remember you? Who were you to me? At that, I stopped walking and turned back to face him. His eyes were dilated to full black, and I suspected all kinds of emotion hid there. Regret, torment, wariness. The other night, why did you call me Angel? I asked.
If I were thinking straight, I'd take you home right now, he said quietly. But I'm tempted to do something I'll probably regret.
Tell me the truth, I hoped. Those black eyes flicked over me.
First, I need to get you off the streets. Hank's men can't be far behind.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Silence by Becca Fitzpatrick. Read by Caitlin Greer with Walter Graham.
Chapter 18. As if on cue, the screech of tires rang out behind us. Hank would be proud. His men didn't give up easily. Jev yanked me behind a crumbling brick wall.
We can't outrun them to the Tahoe, and even if we could, I'm not dragging you into a car chase with Nephilim. They'll walk away from a rolled or totaled car, but you might not. Better to take our chances on foot and circle back to the car after they've given up. There's a nightclub a block from here. Not the cleanest place, but we can hide there.
He took my elbow, propelling me forward. If Hank's men check the club, and they'd be stupid not to since they'll see the Tahoe and know we're on foot, they'll recognize me. The lights in the warehouse were on for a full 5 seconds before you dragged me out. Someone in that room had to have gotten a good look at me. I can try to hide in the bathroom, but if they start asking around, I won't stay hidden long.
The warehouse you broke into is for new recruits. 16 or 17 in human years, a newly sworn.
making them less than one in Nephilim years. I'm stronger than they are, and I've had a lot more practice when it comes to toying with minds. I'm going to put a trance on you. If they look at us, they're going to see a guy in black leather chaps with a spiked choker and a platinum blonde girl in a corset and combat boots. Suddenly, I felt a little light in the head. A trance. Was that how the mind tricks worked? By enchantment? Jev tipped my chin up, searching my eyes. Do you trust me? Whether or not I trusted him didn't matter. The hard truth was, I had to. The alternative was facing down Hank's men alone, and I could guess how that would end. I nodded.
Good. Keep walking.
I followed Jev into a retired factory that now served as Bloody Mary's nightclub, and he handled the cover charge. It took my eyes a moment to adjust to the strobe light pulsing my vision between black and white. The interior walls had been knocked down, allowing for open space that at the moment was crammed with gyrating bodies. Ventilation was poor, and I was immediately hit by a wave of body odor mingled with perfume, cigarette smoke, and vomit. The clientele was a good 15 years older than me, and I was the only person dressed in cords and sporting a ponytail. But Jev's mind tricks must have been working, because amid the sea of chains, leather, spikes, and fishnets, no one batted an eye in my direction. We fought our way to the center of the crowd where we could hide and still keep watch on the doors.
Plan A is to stay here and wait them out, Jev yelled at me over the throb of music. Eventually, they'll have to give up and go back to the warehouse.
And plan B?
If they follow us in here, we'll leave through the back exit.
How do you know there's a back exit?
I've been here before. Not my top choice, but it's a favorite when it comes to my kind.
I didn't want to think about what his kind was. Right now, I didn't want to think about anything but making it home alive. I glanced around. I thought you said you could mind trick everyone. So why do I get the feeling people are staring?
We're the only two people in the room not dancing.
Dancing. Men and women who bore an impressive resemblance to Kiss band members were headbanging, shoving, and licking each other. A guy with chain suspenders holding up his jeans climbed a ladder affixed to the wall and hurled himself into the crowd. To each his own, I thought.
May I have this dance?
Jev asked with a sympathetic tug of his mouth. Shouldn't we be finding a way out of here, devising a couple more backup plans? He clasped my right hand, drawing me against him in a slow dance that was at odds with the racing music. As if reading my mind, he said,
They'll stop staring soon. They're too busy competing for most extreme dance move of the night. Try to relax. Sometimes the best offense is a good defense.
My heart rate picked up then, and not because I knew Hank's men had to be close by. Dancing this way with Jev tore down any chance I had at holding my feelings in check. His arms were strong, his body warm. He wasn't wearing cologne, but there was an intriguing hint of fresh-cut grass and rainwater when he pulled me close. And those eyes. Deep, mysterious, unfathomable. Despite everything, I wanted to lean into him and just let go.
Better, he murmured into my ear.
Before I could respond, he spun me out. I'd never danced like this before, and Jev's skill at it surprised me. Street dancing, I might have guessed, but not this. The way he danced reminded me of another time and place. He was confident and elegant, smooth and sexy. Do you think they're going to buy that a guy in tacky leather chaps dances like this? I scoffed when he twirled me back into his embrace.
Keep it up and I'll put you in the chaps.
He didn't smile, but I sensed an undercurrent of amusement. Glad one of us found something about the situation remotely funny. How do the trances work? Like a glamour?
It's more complicated than that, but same end result.
Could you teach me?
If I taught you everything I know, we'd need a considerable amount of time alone together.
Unsure if he was suggesting anything, I said, I'm sure we could keep it professional.
Speak for yourself.
He said in that same steady tone that made it hard to guess his intentions. His hand was on my back, holding me against him, and I realized I was more nervous than I'd originally thought. I found myself wondering if the connection between us had been this electric before. Had being near him always felt like playing with fire? Warm and bright, intense and dangerous. To keep our conversation from treading further into uncomfortable territory, I laid my head against his chest, even though I knew it wasn't safe. Nothing about him felt safe. My entire body hummed under his touch, a completely foreign and riveting sensation.
The sensible part of me wanted to dissect my emotions, overthinking and overcomplicating my reaction to Jev. But a more physical and immediate part was tired of allowing logic to chase me in circles, constantly wondering about that gap in time, and just like that, I shut off the switch to my brain. Piece by piece, I let Jev break down my defenses. I swayed and dipped against him, letting him set the rhythm. I was overly warm, my head clogged with smoke, and the moment began to feel unreal, only making it easier to believe that later, if guilt or regret haunted me, I could pretend it never happened. While I was here, trapped in the club, trapped in Jev's eyes, he made it too easy to succumb. His mouth grazed my ear. "What are you thinking?" I closed my eyes briefly, drowning in sensation. How warm I feel. How incredibly alive and vibrant and heedless every last inch of me feels next to you. His mouth twisted into a perceptive, sexy smile. Hmm? I looked away, flustered, automatically using irritation to cover my discomfort up. What does hmm have to do with anything? Could you ever use more than 5 words? All this grunting and minced words makes you come across primal. His smile tipped higher. Primal. You're impossible. Me, Jev, you, Nora. Stop it. But I nearly smiled in spite of myself. Since we're keeping it primal, you smell good, he observed. He moved closer, making me acutely aware of his size, the rise and fall of his chest, the warm burn of his skin on mine. Electricity tingled along my scalp, and I shuddered with pleasure. It's called a shower, I began automatically, then trailed off. My memory snagged, taken aback by a compelling and forceful sense of undue familiarity. Soap, shampoo, hot water, I added, almost as an afterthought. Naked, I know the drill, Jev said, something unreadable passing over his eyes. Unsure how to proceed, I attempted to wash away the moment with an airy laugh. Are you flirting with me, Jev? Does it feel that way to you? I don't know you well enough to say either way. I tried to keep my voice level, neutral even. Then we'll have to change that. Still uncertain of his motives, I cleared my throat. Two could play this game. Running from bad guys together is your idea of playing getting to know you? No, this is. He dipped my body backward, drawing me up in a slow arc until he raised me flush against him. In his arms, my joints loosened, my defenses melting as he led me through the sultry steps. His muscles flexed under his clothes, holding me, leading me, never letting me stray far. My knees felt rubbery, but not from dancing. My breathing came faster, and I knew I was treading down a slippery slope. Being this close to Jev, skin brushing, legs touching lightly, gazes connecting briefly in the dark, it was all blind sensation and intoxicating heat. A strange jumble of nervous exhilaration, I pulled away, but not too hard. I don't have the body for this, I quipped, lifting my chin at a voluptuous woman nearby who shook her hips zealously to the beat. No curves. Jev's eyes held mine. Are you asking my opinion? I flushed. I asked for that. He tipped his head down, his breath warming my skin. His lips grazed my forehead with featherweight pressure. I shut my eyes, trying to hold back the absurd desire for him to move his mouth lower until it found my own. Jev, I wanted to say, only his name didn't escape. Jev, 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 I thought in perfect cadence to my heightened pulse. I repeated his name, a silent request, until it spun me dizzy. The sliver of air between our mouths was a vivid presence, teasing and tempting. He was so close, my body attuned to his in a way that both frightened and marveled. I waited, leaning into his embrace, my breath light with anticipation. Suddenly his body grew taut. The spell broke, the gap between us irrevocably widening, and I stepped back. We've got company, Jev said. I tried to pull completely away, but Jev tightened his hold on me, forcing me to keep up the pretense of dancing. Stay calm, he murmured, his cheek brushing my forehead. Remember, if they look at you, they're going to see blonde hair and combat boots. They're not going to see the real you. Won't they expect you to tamper with their minds? I tried to catch a glimpse of the doorway, but several taller men in the crowd blocked me. I couldn't tell if Hank's men were advancing or lingering by the doors, watching.
They didn't get a good look at me, but they saw me jump from the third floor of the warehouse, which will tell them I'm not human. They'll be looking for a guy and a girl together, but that could be any number of couples in here.
What are they doing now? I asked, still unable to see past the crowd.
Having a look around. Dance with me and keep your eyes off the doors. There are four of them. They're spreading out.
Jev swore.
Two are heading this way. I think we've been made. The Black Hand trained them well. I've never met an Aphil who could see through a trance within the first year of swearing fealty, but they just might pull it off. Walk toward the bathrooms and take the exit at the end of the hall. Don't walk too fast and don't look back. If anyone tries to stop you, ignore them and keep walking. I'm going to head them off to buy us time. I'll meet you in the alley in five.
Jev went one way and I went the other, with my heart in my throat. I elbowed my way through the crowd, the heat of too many bodies and my own nervous adrenaline making my skin moist. I veered into the hallway leading to the bathrooms, which, judging by the rancid smell and the swarm of flies, were anything but sanitary. There was a long line, and I had to edge sideways around each person, muttering a hurried, "Excuse me." As Jev promised, a door appeared at the end of the hallway. I pushed through it and found myself outside. Wasting no time, I broke into a jog. I didn't think it was a good idea to stand in the open, choosing instead to hide behind the dumpsters until Jev came for me. I was halfway down the alley when the door swung open behind me.
"Over there!" a voice shouted. "She's getting away!"
I looked back only long enough to confirm they were Nephilim. Then I took off. I didn't know where I was going, but Jev would have to find me elsewhere. I raced across the street, heading back to where we'd abandoned the Tahoe. When Jev didn't find me in the alley, hopefully his car was the next place he'd think to look. The Nephilim were too fast. Even at a full sprint, I could hear them closing in. Everything came 10 times easier to them, I realized with increasing panic. When they were only moments away from seizing me, I whirled around. The two Nephilim slowed, instantly wary of my intentions. I shifted my eyes between them, breathing heavily. I could keep running and draw out the inevitable. I could put up a fight. I could scream bloody murder and hope Jev heard, but every option felt like grasping at straws.
"Is it her?" the shorter one asked with a formal accent that sounded British. He eyed me shrewdly.
"It's her," the taller, an American, confirmed. "She's using a trance. Focus on one detail at a time, the way the Black Hand taught us. Her hair, for instance."
The shorter Nephil squinted at me so intently I wondered if he could see all the way through to the bricks on the building behind me.
"Well, well," he said after a moment. "Red, is it? I preferred you blonde."
With inhuman speed, they were at my sides, each gripping an elbow so hard I winced.
"What were you doing in the warehouse?" the taller Nephil asked. "How did you find it?"
I began, but I was too terrified to think up a plausible lie. They weren't going to believe me if I said sheer dumb luck was responsible for my stumbling through their window in the middle of the night.
"Cat got your tongue," the shorter said, tickling under my chin.
I jerked away.
"We have to take her back to the warehouse," the taller one said. "The Black Hand or Blakely will want to question her."
"They won't be back till tomorrow. Might as well get some answers now."
"What if she doesn't talk?"
The shorter Nephil licked his lips, something frightening lighting up his eyes.
"We'll make sure she does."
The taller Nephil frowned.
"She'll tell them everything."
"We'll wipe her memory when we're done. She won't know the difference."
"We're not strong enough yet. Even if we could erase half of it, it wouldn't be enough."
"We could try Devilcraft," the shorter suggested with a disturbing gleam in his eyes.
"Devilcraft is a myth. The Black Hand made that clear."
"Oh yeah? If the angels in heaven have powers, it makes sense the demons in hell should too. You say myth? I say potential gold mine. Imagine what we could do if we got our hands on it."
"Even if Devilcraft exists, we wouldn't know where to start."
The shorter Nephil wagged his head in irritation.
"Always one for fun, you are. Fine. We make sure our stories match. Our word against hers."
He counted down his suggested version of the night's events on his fingers. "We chased her from the warehouse, found her hiding in the club, and while dragging her back, she got scared and spilled everything. It won't matter what she says happened. She already broke into the warehouse. If anything, the Black Hand expected a lie again." The taller Nephil didn't look fully convinced,
but he didn't argue either. "You're coming with me," the shorter one grunted, forcing me roughly into the tight space between the buildings at our rear. He paused only to tell his friend, "Stay here and make sure nobody bothers us. If we can extract information from her, it just might earn us extra privileges. Maybe even move us up a rank." My whole body went into a slow freeze at the idea of being interrogated by the Nephil, but I'd quickly come to accept that I didn't stand a fighting chance against both of them. Maybe I could press my advantage. My only hope, and even I knew it was a thin one, was to level the playing field by going one-on-one. Letting the shorter Nephil drag me deeper into the narrow breezeway, I hoped the gamble would pay off. "You're making a big mistake," I told him, putting all the threat I possessed behind my words. He rolled up his sleeves, exposing knuckles decorated with various sharp rings, and my courage suddenly felt slippery. "Been in America 6 months now, waking up at the crack of dawn, training all day under a tyrant, and locked up in the barracks at night. After 6 months of that prison, let me tell you, it's going to feel good to take it out on someone." He licked his lips. "I'm going to enjoy this, love." "You stole my line," I said, and shoved my knee up between his legs. I'd seen enough guys at school take a similar hit during sports games or PE class to know the injury wouldn't completely immobilize him, but I wasn't expecting him to be ready to lunge at me after nothing more than a pained moan. He came at me in a blur. There was a discarded 2x4 near my feet, and I snatched it up. Several rusty nails protruded from it, making it a useful weapon. The Nephil eyed the block of wood and shrugged. "Go ahead. Try and hit me. Won't hurt." I gripped the 2x4 like a bat. "It might not permanently injure you, but trust me, it will hurt." He faked to his right, but I was expecting it. When he jumped to his left, I swung down hard. There was an awful puncturing sound, and the Nephil yelped. "That's gonna cost you." He kicked high before I had time to register the movement, his boot sending the wood out of my grasp. He wrestled me to the ground, pinning my arms over my head. "Get off me," I yelled, twisting under his weight. "Sure thing, love. Just tell me what you were doing at the safe house." "Get off me now." "You heard her." The Nephil's eyes widened in impatience. "What now?" he snapped, whipping his head around to see who dared interrupt us. "It was an easy enough request," Jev said, smiling slightly, but it was all lethality at the edges. "I'm a little busy at the moment, mate," the Nephil barked, raking his eyes over me for emphasis. "If you don't mind." "Turns out, I do." Jev grabbed the Nephil by the shoulders and flung him against the building. He splayed his hand across the Nephil's throat, shutting off his airway. "Apologize." With a flick of his head, Jev gestured in my direction. The Nephil clawed at Jev's hand, his face flaring with color. His mouth opened and closed like a fish's, trying to draw oxygen. "Tell her how deeply sorry you are, or I'll make sure you have nothing to say for a good while longer." With his free hand, Jev waved a switchblade, and I realized he meant to cut out the Nephil's tongue. For what it was worth, I didn't feel a shred of sympathy. "What's it going to be?" The Nephil's eyes burned with rage as he glanced between me and Jev. "Sorry," his infuriated voice spat into my mind. "Won't win an Oscar, but it'll do," Jev told him with a vicious smile. "That wasn't so hard, was it?" Wrenching free, the Nephil gulped air and massaged his throat. "Do I know you? I know you're a fallen angel. I can feel your power rolling off you like a stench, which makes me think you must have been pretty high up before you fell. Maybe even an archangel. But what I want to know is if we've crossed paths before." It seemed like a trick question meant to help the Nephil track Jev down at some future point, but Jev wasn't baited. "Not yet," he said. "I'll keep the introduction short." He plowed his fist into the Nephil's gut. The Nephil's mouth was still in the shape of an O when he sank to his knees and went slack. Jev turned to me. I expected him to demand why I hadn't stayed in the alley like we'd agreed, and how I'd wound up with the present company, but he simply wiped a smudge of dirt off my cheek and buttoned the top two buttons on my blouse. "You okay?" he asked quietly. I nodded, but felt tears swell at the back of my throat. "Let's get out of here," he said. For once, I didn't protest. Chapter 19. As Jev drove, I leaned my head against the window, staying quiet.
He kept to side roads and back roads, but I had a rough idea of where we were. Another few turns and I knew exactly where we were. The entrance to Delphic Amusement Park loomed ahead, imposing and skeletal. Jeff pulled into the vacant lot. 4 hours ago, he would have been lucky to find a place half this close to the gates. "What are we doing here?" I asked, sitting up straighter. He shut off the engine, arching a dark brow.
"You said you wanted to talk."
"Yeah, but this place is... empty." A hard smile touched his mouth.
"Still don't know if you can trust me? As for why Delphic? Call me sentimental."
If I was supposed to catch his meaning, I didn't. I followed him to the gates, watching him vault up and over them with ease. On the other side, he pushed the gate open just wide enough to allow me entrance. "Could we go to jail for this?" I asked, knowing it was a stupid question. If we were caught, how could we not? But because Jeff looked like he knew what he was doing, I followed. Above the lamplight, a roller coaster towered over the park. An image blazed across my mind, momentarily halting me. I saw myself hurtling off the tracks into a free fall. I swallowed, brushing the image off as having to do with my terror of heights. I was growing more uneasy by the minute. Just because Jeff had saved my skin 3 times didn't mean it was a good idea to be alone with him. I supposed I'd been lulled here by the idea of answers. Jeff had promised we'd talk, and the temptation had been too appealing to resist. At last, Jeff slowed, veering off the walkway and coming to a stop before a ramshackle maintenance shed. It was overshadowed by the roller coaster on one side and a giant spinning wheel on the other. The squat gray structure was the last place anyone's eyes would travel. "What's in the shed?" I asked.
"Home."
Home? Either he had a sense of humor or he was redefining simple living. "Glamorous." A shrewd smile crept to his mouth.
"I sacrificed style for safety."
I eyed the weathered paint, sloped awning, and paper-thin construction. "Safe? I could probably kick down the door."
"Safe from the archangels."
At the word, I felt a jab of panic. I remembered my last hallucination. "Help me find an archangel's necklace," Hank had said. The coincidence tingled unpleasantly under my skin. Inserting his key, Jeff opened the shed door and held it for me. "When do I get to find out about the archangels?" I asked. I sounded glib, but nerves were making a wreck of my stomach. Just how many different angel spin-offs were there?
"All you need to know is that right now they're not on our side."
I read deeper into his tone. "But they might be later?"
"I'm an optimist."
I stepped over the threshold, thinking there had to be more to the shed than met the eye. If the walls would be spared by a gusty wind, I'd be amazed. The floorboards creaked under my weight, and I breathed in the smell of stale air. The shed was small, about 15 by 10 feet, no windows. The space fell to total darkness when Jeff let the door shut behind us. "You live here?" I asked, just to be sure.
"This is more like the antechamber."
Before I could ask what that meant, I heard him cross the shed. There was the low whine of a door opening. When he spoke again, his voice was much lower to the ground.
"Give me your hand."
I shuffled over, wading through blackness, until I felt him grasp my hand. It seemed he was standing below me in a recessed area. His hands moved to my waist. He lifted me down, into a space beneath the shed. We stood face to face in the darkness. I felt him breathing, low and steady. My own breathing was less regular. Where was he taking me? "What is this place?" I whispered.
"There's a labyrinth of tunnels beneath the park, layer upon layer of mazes. Years ago, fallen angels didn't mingle with humans. They separated themselves, living out here on the coast, going into towns and villages only during Heshvan to possess their Nephilim vassals' bodies. A 2-week vacation, and those towns were like their resorts. They did what they wanted, took what they wanted, filled their pockets with their vassals' money. These cliffs by the ocean were remote, but fallen angels built their cities underground as a precaution. They knew that over time things would change, and they did. Humans expanded. The boundary between human and fallen angel territory blurred. Fallen angels built Delphic on top of their city to hide it. When they opened the amusement park, they used the revenue to sustain themselves."
His voice was so measured, so steady, I didn't know how he